and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. If you've not become an Undivided subscriber already, I always remind you at the top of the show, just $5 a month, you get a bonus episode every week, and you can help support the work that we're doing to try to give common sense a comeback in politics and in the press. You can do that in two ways at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. I'm not even going to preview the stories that we're doing today because I want to dive right into something that happened over the weekend that I find disturbing on a number of levels. And I hope what you come away with is an understanding of just how far some mainstream media outlets have fallen. And look, I'm not too far removed from mainstream media. I was a mainstream journalist in Seattle for 12 years. It was never someone who thought I would leave, who thought I would go do something independent. But for, you know, all the reasons that I've outlined over the past year, you know, I had been just disappointed, I think, with the state of things. There's something that happened over the weekend to another independent journalist who was covering a protest in Renton, Washington, which is just south of Seattle, if you're not familiar. And the mainstream media's response or lack of response to what happened to this independent journalist is problematic and concerning. So Katie Davis Court is an independent journalist. She's a conservative. She certainly has an opinion and shares it, but so do a lot of other independent outlets in Seattle, like The Stranger. She is an independent journalist, does reporting for Rebel News, but she's based in Seattle. So Katie Davis Court was covering a protest outside Brewmaster's Tap Room in Renton, Washington, which is just south of Seattle. And it was a protest over a drag queen story hour happening in the brewery. Essentially, there had been some controversy over this drag queen story time, and really, in anticipation of the possibility that there could be people who show up in opposition to the drag queen story time, you had a lot of pro-LGBTQ protesters come out and rally kind of in support. And you also had members of Antifa show up, which we know that they often do in order to sort of pick a fight and start something with anybody who might be out there who they don't agree with. So while Katie Davis Court was covering this protest, she says that one of the members of Antifa assaulted her and stole her cell phone. She talked about it after the fact.
I was filming Drag Queen Story Hour in Renton, Washington, covering the event for Rebel News, and Antifa swarmed me with their umbrellas, and then one of them robbed me. They stole my phone and assaulted me. So right now, I'm with a lovely police officer of Renton PD, and I'm going to file a report and hopefully get my phone back.
Now, because she didn't have a cell phone to call 911, Katie Davis Court, again, an independent journalist, says she went around asking mainstream media members who were present at the protest if they would help her call 911. One of those interactions was with a King 5 news photographer. It was actually captured on video by one of the members of Antifa, who had been following Katie around while she tried to find a phone to call 911. And you'll hear her just harassing Katie, being completely nasty to her, while Katie's asking this King 5 photographer if he can help her call 911.
You can call the police if you want to. Feel free.
How? I don't have a phone.
Oh, you have your phone.
I'm not getting it.
Yes. No, don't. You're a fascist, Katie. No one's going to help fascists. You Proud Boy Barbie. No one's going to help you here.
In case you couldn't make it out there, when Katie approaches the King 5 news photographer, he says, "That's not on me. You'll have to figure it out." Rather than giving her his phone to call 911, rather than, if that made him uncomfortable, calling 911 for her.
You can call the police if you want to. Feel free.
How? I don't have a phone.
Oh, you have your phone.
I'm not getting it.
Yes, no.
This was an independent journalist, but above all, this was a human being. This was a young woman who approaches this man, journalist or not, and informs him that she needs to call 911. And his response is, you know, that's on you. You'll need to figure it out. Now, Katie Davis Court later tweeted about this moment that's captured in video. She says, "I have never felt more hopeless than this moment. Sadly, this King 5 Seattle photographer wasn't the only one I asked for help. I also asked reporter Deborah Horn at Cairo 7 News for help in calling the police too, but she refused. It's unfortunate because I had her back in the past. So here you have two members of the mainstream media who, according to Katie Davis Court, refused to help her when she came up and said, I need to call 911. I've just been robbed. It's unacceptable behavior for any human being to human being. But it's also an increasing problem when it comes to the Seattle news media, shunning anyone, any journalist, any commentator who has a right-leaning bias. Now, I've reached out to Cairo 7 and to King 5 for comment to ask, is there any additional context? Is there any additional information that we're not seeing, that's not being shared? Can you explain to us why your news crews wouldn't help out someone who was in need, who'd just been victimized, who needed to call the police but didn't have a cell phone? So far, I haven't heard back, which doesn't surprise me, to be frank. I've also reached out directly to Deborah Horn because here is something that really bothers me about that in particular. I have long discussed the need for the media to stand up for one another when they're under attack, be it when they're under attack from a politician like Donald Trump, or when they are quite honestly physically under attack, like what happened to my crew at Chaz Chop when we were mobbed. And when no one from the mainstream media came to our defense, when it wasn't turned into a news story, as it should have been, when members of the mainstream media got on and said it was like a mostly peaceful event or blamed the police for what was happening at Chaz Chop. I remember when our crew was mobbed there, a still photographer, a freelance still photographer, walking backwards as we tried to get away from the mob, snapping photographs rather than trying to help. And that same summer in 2020, Deborah Horn was mobbed by protesters. What happened is there was a BLM protest at Seattle's Westlake Park. And Deborah Horn, being a legendary Black TV reporter in Seattle, you would think that she would be treated with an ounce of respect at a BLM rally. But instead, what happened, and it was captured on video, is these mostly white young protesters at Westlake Park surrounded Deborah Horn and forced her to leave the park where she was simply trying to cover a rally. When this happened to Deborah Horn, again, it was November of 2020, I took to Twitter and lost it. These are tweets I sent out after Deborah Horn was mobbed at Westlake Park. I said, the absolute gall of these white people claiming to care about Black lives disrespecting Deborah and the Cairo 7 Seattle crew in this way. I'm about to have a full-blown Twitter meltdown, you guys. I went on to say, I can't understand it. This is and has been mortifying to watch this continue to our friends in the news. Leaders need to speak up. Enough is enough. I went on to say, absolutely pathetic. A BLM rally and you harass Deborah, who is not only a Seattle legend, but a woman of color. You are so backward. I'd feel bad for you if it weren't so gross at this point. You don't care about Black lives. You only care about yourselves. So unequivocally, I came to Deborah Horn's defense. And I have to wonder, after the lack of action to help Katie Davis Court, would Deborah Horn come to my defense if I were mobbed, if I were harassed, if I came to her and said, hey, they just stole my phone. Can I use yours to call 911? The other thing about the incident with Deborah Horn in 2020, when I sent out those tweets, I also sent out the video her own station posted of the incident where she was harassed by these BLM protesters. Initially, that was put out by Cairo 7 on social media, showing exactly what happened to Deborah Horn. But then, and I recall this very well, the video was taken down, which I thought was odd. It was certainly newsworthy. Here you have a reporter trying to cover a protest and they're mobbed. It certainly speaks to the crowd's state of mind, their propensity for violence and harassment. So when Deborah Horn's video of her being mobbed was taken down, I thought, well, that's odd. And I reached out to a friend of mine who worked at Cairo 7. And at the time, this is what they told me about why the video was taken down. Now, I reached back out to this friend today and said, hey, you told me this in confidence 2 years ago. Can I make it public now? And they said, absolutely. This was the reason why video of Deborah Horn being confronted and harassed and forced to leave Westlake Park by BLM protesters was taken down. Quote, she is worried it'll hurt her ability to cover that group in the future. So a group that has just harassed her, intimidated her and her crew, forced them out of a public park. Rather than shed light on that, you make the decision to take the video down because, quote, it will hurt her ability to cover that group in the future. So you're talking about a group that harasses and intimidates journalists, and your concern is being able to cover that group in the future, being able to what, maintain a good relationship with that group? Do you think for a second that if Deborah Horn had been forced out of Westlake Park by a group of right-wing protesters that they would have taken that video down? Not for a second. It would have been the lead in their 5 o'clock newscast. Instead, they buried it. They deleted it because she wanted to be able to cover that group in the future. So they bury a clear instance video evidence of violence from left-wing protesters. And then you fast forward in 2 years, and when independent journalist Katie Davis Court is robbed by one of these members of Antifa who don't want her filming, what does Deborah Horn allegedly do? What does the King 5 photog allegedly do? You're on your own. It's disgusting. And again, I hope that King 5 or Cairo 7 get back to me and have some sort of magical explanation for all of this. But I am not going to hold my breath. And to me also, and I want to play for you. So there is clearly an issue here with if that had been, you know, a reporter from The Stranger, someone with a left-leaning bias, another member of the mainstream media who came up to them and said, oh my God, Antifa just robbed me of my phone. Can I use yours to call 911? Wouldn't even have been a question. So I really believe that this is political and it was about their opinion of Katie Davis Court. When it should just be about humanity. Nobody deserves to have their phone stolen. Nobody deserves to be assaulted. Nobody deserves to feel that helpless. Why would you ever respond to another human being in that way and turn them away when they need help, especially a young woman? Come on. Now, there's some other elements of all this, and I'm going into detail on this because it really, really matters. There's some other elements to all this that bother me immensely. The protest they were all covering was over this drag queen story time. Now, drag queen story times have been controversial across the country because there have been some incidents where some of these drag queens were not wearing much clothing. And you've got little kids sitting in front of them. There were some instances where kids were exposed to genitals, etc. Now, this drag queen story time seemed to be pretty PG. It was a drag queen dressed kind of as an old lady reading a book. And look, I think parents should have a right to take their kids where they want to take their kids. Do I question a parent who might take their child, their young child, to a bar to watch a drag show and dancing? And, you know, some of the instances we've seen of people, kids being given money to give to drag queens. Yeah, that's weird to me. It's like taking your kid to a strip club. It's bizarre. But look, if you're a parent, you want to take your kid to this Renton drag queen story time, which seemed, you know, fine. And like I said, PG-13, fine, do it. But you can't argue that there aren't some legitimate criticisms to be had about these particular events. I think there are some very common sense criticisms to have about exposing young children, in some cases, to very scantily clad drag queens who might be dancing or whatever it is. So as an aside to whatever happened to Katie Davis Court outside, I watched the reports that King 5 News and Cairo 7 filed about this particular event and what was going on outside. Neither of the reports mentioned that there was an assault and a robbery outside, that there was some, neither of the reports even alluded to any potential problems that occurred outside of this event, even though we know that King 5 News knew what happened to Katie Davis Court and Cairo 7 News knew what happened to Katie Davis Court because Katie came up to them and told them. So not only was that left out of the reporting, but I'm going to play both of these news reports for you. And you tell me that there isn't an obvious, clear bias in their coverage of, again, drag queen story time, an issue that there have been some legitimate concerns and criticisms about.
Support lining the streets in Renton Saturday with allies surrounding Brewmaster's Tap Room, rallying around this.
The little blue truck
inside
is full of cheer.
The Tap Room's monthly drag queen story hour it's been hosting for a year and a half, but this time it's a packed house.
Suddenly we got national exposure this week when some people just got all upset about it.
The Tap Room's owner Marley Rawl says social media posts began spreading about a planned protest earlier this week, sparking a surge of threats and insults. And by Wednesday, Renton PD says someone shot what appears to be a BB through the window.
It's not Christmas.
While the support and new faces are a warm welcome.
Good job keeping this up.
Oh. We're just doing what we're doing, man.
Rawl says it shouldn't even be an issue.
We should have just have our kids hanging out. They shouldn't have to worry about coming in to enjoy a human being reading a book to them.
Dear Santa.
Dozens of kids came to hear Sylvia read Christmas classics, many of them coming for the first time.
She's awesome. I just wanted to be a part of it, right? I wanted to, like, even if it was nobody here, I would still show up.
Because all we're doing is trying to teach young children that it's all right to be reaching out and spreading love and acceptance to everybody, which I think is the best message everybody needs.
This comes a week after the Department of Homeland Security warns of domestic terror threats to the LGBTQ community and other groups. While safety is in the back of their mind, supporters outside say now is the time to stay strong.
I grew up in Nigeria and I was bullied a lot for being gay. And when that came, I had a bit of a flashback. And I was scared for a bit, but then I remember that we can't hide in our fear.
And showing up.
This shows love for her and for you.
Is the message loud and clear.
To show all we exist.
In Renton.
That any oppression, we must always resist.
Julie Calhoun, King 5.
Activists show support for a bar they believe was targeted because of its weekly drag queen story time. The crowd gathered outside the Brewmaster's Tap Room in Renton just 3 days after someone fired a shot into the business. That's when the owner decided to move that story time inside and when activists decided to show their support. Cairo 7's Deborah Horn is live now in Renton. And Deborah, this action surprised even the owner of the tap room.
It absolutely did, Gwen. Not only is she surprised by this, and you see here, there's just a few of the people who were here at the height of this, but surprised because of the reason for it, that someone fired onto her bar days before children usually gather here for drag queen story time. It felt and looked like a prelude to a big pride event. But these gay rights activists stood outside an unassuming bar in Renton's Fairwood neighborhood to lend support.
Today we're going to dance, today we're going to march, and today we're going to stand for our LGBTQIA community members and our community members of Renton.
All because of this.
Beep, beep, beep. December's here.
A drag queen's weekly telling of stories
every
to children
Christmas,
inside
Little
the
Blue
Brewmaster Tap Room, something
job.
Sylvia Ostafermore says she has done here for a year and a half.
But you can see, so I've got all the books that I'm reading tonight that I can choose from. These are classics, award-winning, you know, different ones that we've been finding. It's nothing, I'm not brainwashing children. Plus the parents are here. I'm not kidnapping neighborhood kids to come down here and listen to stories. That's ridiculous.
But last Wednesday, someone fired a pellet or BB gun into the business, sparking fear. So the bar's owner decided to move story time inside, lest whoever shot at the business come back. And the story went viral.
Yeah, unfortunately.
You say unfortunately.
Yeah, we're just a small community gathering spot that has kind of blown up. We're just trying to let somebody read a book to kids.
And it rallied the first out gay member of the Renton City Council to their cause, ignoring, she says, their constant fear.
So we wait for moments like this so we can show up and be the allies, be the supporters, be the warriors that our ancestors, the people who came before us, were.
In fact, there had been concern that those protesting the story time would show up. If they did, they didn't make themselves known. Now, Renton police did promise that they would have additional patrols, and we did see a couple of uniformed officers, at least for a time, inside the bar. But let me tell you, it is really crowded in there. This is the biggest drag queen story time they've ever had here, and they say what happened Wednesday won't stop it from being here again. They plan to continue. Reporting live in Renton, Deborah Horn, Cairo 7 News.
Now, look, I'm not saying that the news needs to platform people who might be outside who genuinely are hateful, who hate gay people, like who are, you know, I don't know, white, whatever it is. I'm not saying they have to platform hateful, ignorant opinions. But surely when you're covering a story like that, surely you can find a parent, or there is going to be a parent or a protester who is able to explain why they oppose drag queen story time for young kids. So you have these two news reports that don't mention anything of what happened outside the event and are essentially an endorsement of the event. Now, there's a third element to this whole ordeal that bothers me and should bother anyone who expects accountability from the media. You know, in the press, our job is to hold powerful people accountable. In that sense, we have a tremendous amount of responsibility and a tremendous amount of power. But there's always this question of, okay, whose job is it to hold the media accountable when the media makes errors? And I've noticed this really concerning pattern of mainstream media organizations not wanting to hold themselves to the same level of accountability that they hold members of the public and politicians. King 5 News, as an example, there have been several instances where a decision from King 5 News has been talked about on conservative radio, so like Jason Rantz, Dory Monson, or where I've done a story about it. So a couple of these things. You might recall on the podcast, I did a story about how King 5 News had basically a false story on hormone blockers reducing rates of depression in teens. Jason Rantz is a friend of mine who covered that story, and he'd reached out to King 5 News repeatedly for comment. And I don't know if eventually they got back to him, but for days they didn't say anything. He had alerted them to the error, asked for comment. 9 days went by before they corrected what was a blatantly false article. And they didn't put out any sort of statement acknowledging the error and how serious it was, how their error in reporting could have influenced a parent's decision to get their child hormone blockers. They just quietly went in and made some corrections. To me, that is not holding yourself accountable. Now, I also had reached out to King 5 News a couple times about a homicide suspect who had murdered a woman, brutally murdered a woman. And in the police report, he told officers that the Quran, he'd read the Quran, and his interpretation of it was that he needed to do this. Yet King 5 News and several other outlets in town acted as if police didn't have a possible motive. They didn't make any mention of the Quran, which was a key part of the statement this murder suspect made to police. But they completely left it out. And the point I made at the time was, would they have left that out if it was a Christian nationalist? If it was a white Christian who said, I read the Bible and the Bible told me I had to kill this woman. You think they would have left that out? Of course not. And I reached out repeatedly to King 5 News for comment on their reporting, and I never heard back. And again, haven't heard back from King 5 News yet about what happened with this photographer in Katie Davis court. So you demand answers from everyone else. You go around holding everyone else accountable, but you're not willing to be accountable for your own news coverage. You're not willing to be accountable for the information that you're putting out to the public, for how your crew members conduct themselves in public. That should be problematic to anyone. When you have entities as powerful as the news media refusing to hold themselves accountable to the same standard that they expect of everyone else. So, you know, I feel terrible for Katie Davis Court. No one deserves for that to happen to them. And no one deserves to, in a moment of need, be turned away. And for what? What reason? I have a hard time believing it's not over politics. I have a hard time believing that if it was someone else coming up to them to ask for help, their response would have been something other than, that's on you. You're on your own to figure it out. It really is quite shameful behavior from members of the press. The following segment is brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Earlier this month on the show, I told you that it's time to be on the lookout for bad bills being pre-filed in Washington State. And as I said, my rationale was you can't wait until these bills get hearings and get momentum in Olympia. You really have to start speaking out about them early and often. And there are a couple bills that have now been pre-filed that I want to discuss because I think it shows really a frustrating lack of a lack of common sense priorities among the majority party in Olympia. And it's this continued effort to pass bills to make the lives of criminals easier, as opposed to making the lives of everyday citizens who are following the rules, following the laws, paying their taxes, as opposed to doing something to make our lives easier. The focus and the attention on making the lives of criminals easier is a strange thing to me. Now, I've said before, before we dive into these, that, you know, I think if you make a mistake in your life and you end up incarcerated or in prison, the system ought to function in a way that sets you up to be in a better position and get on a better path once you are out of prison, because the vast majority of people who go to prison will get out someday. And so, you know, it's not as if I'm not one of those lock them up and throw away the key. I'm not one of those people. I understand that reducing recidivism is very important, and, you know, making sure that felons can find a place to live, can find a job, etc. But that being said, I think that Democrats in Washington State have gone too far time and time again in focusing on the needs of criminals as opposed to the needs of everyone else in the population. So I'm going to give you a couple examples. One of those is House Bill 1024. What it would do is a couple things. It would, so if you're incarcerated and, you know, in prison, you can work to make some money. Now, one of the things that money can go to is helping to offset the cost of your incarceration. So for instance, if a court determines at sentencing that the offender has the means to pay for the cost of their own incarceration, the court can order that they do so. It's like, you're the one who got in trouble. You're the one who committed a burglary or whatever it was. And if you can pay for the cost of your own incarceration, why should the taxpayers have to bear that burden? Like, I'm sorry, you're going to pay the $50 a day or whatever it is. Well, this bill would eliminate that. Even if you're behind bars, incarcerated, working a prison job, none of that money would go to offsetting the cost of your incarceration, and it would allow the inmate to keep more of that money. It would also mandate that prisoners who are working get paid at least the state minimum wage. So again, you're working to make the lives of criminals easier behind bars. You're putting that burden on the backs of the taxpayers. So as opposed to these people who committed a crime, who are in prison by their own choices, as opposed to them trying to work off the cost of that incarceration, trying to offset the cost of that incarceration, no, we have state lawmakers who say, oh, the taxpayers who are minding their own business, who are working hard, who are paying their taxes, they'll take care of that for you. Don't worry. You be in prison, you just focus on doing whatever people in prison do. Don't worry about the taxpayers. They'll be fine. It's a weird priority for me. Now, there's another bill that was pre-filed that I think indirectly helps criminals. So this is a bill that would end qualified immunity in Washington state for members of law enforcement. So a police officer could be personally sued for an action they take against an individual citizen if that action is determined not to be in line with proper protocols and training, etc. Now, I think that there are some instances where if you have an officer who acts egregiously, I understand sort of the desire to go after that officer civilly, but you also have to understand the chilling effect that that can have on law enforcement. When you, as an officer, personally make a decision in a moment of frenzy, in a moment where your life might be in danger or the lives of someone else might be in danger, and if you make the wrong decision in that moment, you could be financially bankrupt. You could have everything you've worked for, everything your family has, be taken away from you. If you think for one second that officers won't completely eliminate proactive efforts in policing, then you're fooling yourself. Why would you as an officer go out on a limb? Why would you proactively put yourself in situations investigating possible crimes if you know that any decision you make could mean financial ruin? So you're going to have a lot of criminals who are going to get away with a lot of things because police aren't doing work proactively. Look, again, I don't think police officers should be above the law. I don't think anyone thinks police officers should be above the law. But it is a difficult job they undertake with complex rules and regulations surrounding it. And those of us who don't do the job, we have no idea the stress involved in split-second decisions. Now, there's one more bill. I don't think it's been pre-filed yet. But I know that it's been floated, and it's been floated by our friend Senator Joe Wynn, who we've had on the show before. I'll have to invite him back on to talk about this. But it's another one of these things where it's like, what about the people who are following the rules? So this would end low-level traffic stops for things like a broken taillight or expired tabs, where it's not an immediate, imminent public safety danger. The argument being that there's a disproportionate impact on low-income people and people of color. And it gets people entangled in this criminal legal system when maybe they didn't have the money to fix a broken taillight or they didn't have the money to re-up their tabs. And again, you know, I don't think that you have to throw the book at everyone who has an expired tab or everyone who has a broken taillight. But also, again, I go back to law-abiding citizens who are following rules. You know, there's a lot of people who pay to renew the tabs and do so even though it presents a huge financial burden. You know, the state of Washington has repeatedly rejected demands of voters for $35 car tabs to make them more affordable for everyone. And the state and King County, they just keep raising the cost of new car tabs. And then you're going to say, we're going to make car tabs really, really expensive, but we don't want police pulling over people who don't renew their car tabs because car tabs are too expensive. Like, what sense does that make in the world? So these are just a few of the bills that I'm watching because I think it's really messed up priorities. And I would like to see the majority party in Olympia, the Democrats, do something for once to help folks who are working hard. Do something for once to help folks who are following all the rules and following all the laws. Give us a break. Instead of continually trying to make life easier on people who don't follow the rules. The preceding segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Okay, the Twitter files just keeps rolling on. Barry Weiss has been one of the independent journalists that Elon Musk has sort of entrusted with this data. And today she sent out the Twitter files part 5, and it covers the removal of former President Donald Trump from Twitter, the decision and what was happening behind the scenes that led to this. And there's a couple interesting things. And I've said this before, you know, I It's fascinating to watch the two different ways that the Twitter files have been painted. Either it's like blockbuster revelations or it's a nothing burger. It's like there's nothing in between. I tend to think that there's some very interesting information that has come out from the Twitter files. Some of it's not really surprising. I think a lot of us thought that's probably what was happening behind the scenes, but we didn't have the actual evidence to show it, to prove it. And this sort of serves to do that. But I also think there were some good conversations and some dissent happening behind the scenes at Twitter, which is also important to realize. You know, there were folks in these thread Slack channels at Twitter who were really going out on a limb to take issues with some of the decisions that were being made around account suspension, locking accounts, etc., and also when it came to former President Donald Trump. So, of course, Donald Trump was permanently suspended from Twitter after a couple days after the January 6th attack on the Capitol. So he had been at the time, and what Barry Weiss reports in this thread on Twitter is that January 8th comes around, so 2 days later, and Donald Trump had one remaining strike left before he would risk a permanent suspension based on Twitter rules. And that day, he sent out two tweets. One of them was, "The 75 million great American patriots who voted for me, America First, and Make America Great Again will have a giant voice long into the future. They will not be disrespected or treated unfairly in any way, shape, or form." His second tweet was, "To all those who have asked, I will not be going to the inauguration on January 20th. So what happened after that is this internal discussion at Twitter as to whether either of those tweets would justify giving Donald Trump the final strike needed to suspend his account permanently. And one of the really interesting things that Barry Weiss does in this thread is she gives examples of how Twitter has responded to blatant threats of violence, for instance, from other leaders around the world. So, because what she's doing is giving us a baseline for here's how Twitter has handled questionable tweets from other world leaders versus how they handled questionable tweets from Donald Trump. So in 2018, the Ayatollah of Iran tweeted, "Israel is a malignant cancerous tumor in the West Asian region and has to be removed and eradicated. It is possible and it will happen." So Twitter didn't delete that tweet, and they didn't ban the Ayatollah for that tweet, despite it being a threat against Israel. And I mean, I don't understand how you could say that that's not a threat of violence, right? And then she has an example of this tweet from the former Malaysian prime minister sent in October 2020, where he says, "Muslims have a right to be angry and to kill millions of French people for the massacres of the past." Okay, pretty blatant, right? Well, Twitter did delete that tweet for glorifying violence, but he still has his Twitter account. They didn't permanently suspend his Twitter account like they did Donald Trump's. So anyway, all of that, just as context, Barry Weiss lays out the conversations happening behind the scenes, where essentially there were some Twitter employees who were just looking to bend the rules to fit what Donald Trump had tweeted on the morning of January 8th, because they were just itching to suspend him permanently. But there were Twitter employees pushing back, saying that they did not see policy violations in Trump's tweet, that they did not believe that those tweets amounted to an incitement to violence. And in fact, the internal unit at Twitter that officially reviews those things said that they determined internally that Trump's tweets were not in violation of Twitter policy. So as this is going on, Twitter executives, they have an all-staff meeting. They field questions from employees about, you know, why they haven't taken action on Trump yet. And then just sort of out of nowhere, Twitter internally changes its decision-making and says, yes, one of these tweets was a violation of policy, and they suspend Trump permanently. So it's really a fascinating, this was one of, I think, the most interesting threads, because it shows how Twitter, it wasn't committed to really looking at its rules and applying them evenly, no matter who, you know, committed a violation. it was taking its rules and bending them to fit the needs, or in some cases, the demands of employees at Twitter who wanted to see Trump gone. And there was just so much pressure internally that Twitter ultimately relented to its employees and said, OK, he's gone. And then you permanently ban the president of the United States when, as Barry Weiss laid out, you have all these other examples of world leaders who had said far worse things on Twitter who got to keep their accounts. And that should get anyone concerned and thinking about how Twitter, the influence Twitter has and the way it uses that influence. And so I would be highly skeptical, if I were you, of anyone who is outright dismissing the Twitter files as a non-story. One more thing I wanted to get to today is Kyrsten Sinema's decision to leave the Democratic Party. I didn't talk about it on Friday because I was traveling and the show was pre-taped on Thursday, and she came out with that announcement on Friday. I can't say it's much of a surprise, but I do think it fits a really interesting trend of Democrats alienating the moderates in their party. We've seen it happen in Washington State, where, you know, Governor Jay Inslee supported a primary, a challenger to a sitting Democrat who's a moderate. And with Kyrsten Sinema, I mean, think about all the ways that she's been vilified, that Senator Joe Manchin has been vilified from members of their own party from the progressive wing for standing firm, particularly on fiscal issues, like the price tag of the Build Back Better Act, where they're like, listen, you can't justify spending trillions of dollars on this. You're going to have to cut it down. And so, you know, it's fascinating to me to watch Democrats completely reject the moderates in their own party. And I think that they're doing that to their own peril, because we know that moderates and independents, we are the majority, right? And you kind of will usually fall in one camp or lean toward one camp or the other, but there is an awful lot of swing voters out there, and swing voters decide elections. So I think it's a very odd strategy, a very odd practice for the Democratic Party to be catering to the fringe of its party, as opposed to saying, hey, let's cater to the group of people that makes up the majority of voters. So I commend Kyrsten Sinema for her decision to be an independent. I think that her rationale for that speaks to a lot of the things that we discuss on Undivided, where she sees these two parties that are so busy fighting each other that they're not fighting for the American people anymore. And she wants to try to remove that partisanship from the equation. She wants to get down to business. She wants to do the work of the people of Arizona. And she thinks the best way to do that is to remove herself from this really toxic two-party system that we have in this country. And I think that you're going to start to see this more and more often. And I know it's a hard thing to do because you lose that party infrastructure and you lose the power that comes with a party. But I do think that you're going to start to see the power of both parties wane over time as some of these politicians, and I think there's a lot on the Republican side, too, who haven't liked the direction of their party and who I can see is making more sense for them to be independents than Republicans. And so what I hope the effect that this has is for both parties to really reevaluate, who should we be catering to? Whose interests should we be most concerned with? It should probably be the majority, the overwhelming majority of Americans who aren't hyper-partisan, who want the government to work for them, who are tired of the bickering. I don't know how long it's going to take for both parties to sort of make that realization that, hey, we, you know, because I made the comment during the midterm elections that all of a sudden when a big election year comes up, all of the candidates pretend to be moderates. And then when they get into office and they win, they ignore moderates and cater to the fringes of their party. And it's such a weird thing to me. And I don't know why voters continually fall for it, you know, when they have Democrats, for instance, who spend all this time on anti-police and policies making crime worse. And then all of a sudden during the election, they're like, oh, I love the police and I want to help the crime crisis. It's like you can only lie like that and gaslight so many times before voters have to catch on to it. Right. So anyway, good for Kyrsten Sinema. I hope there are other members of Congress who decide to join her. All right. It's Monday. We end the day with reading a few of your comments. And I wanted to read some comments on the Katie Davis Court situation. I think, You know, one of the things that disappoints me about some of these comments, and these are not on Patreon or Locals, because I don't think that I have subscribers who would say these types of things, but I wanted to read you some of what's being said on Twitter, because it's really fascinating how people will make excuses for violence if they support the political leanings of the person committing the act of violence or committing the crime. And it's a really sad state of affairs. And I saw all these comments on Twitter. I mean, there are a lot of people standing up for Katy Davis Court, obviously. But there's also some folks who are like, oh, well, you know, she's the actual problem. Jerry Senderson says, the age-old problem, extremist activists pretending to be legitimate reporters. No, Katy doesn't pretend to be a legitimate, straightforward journalist. She is an independent journalist who shares her opinion. That is a recognized part of the media ecosystem. You're allowed to be a member of the media and share your opinion, and she doesn't hide it. It would be different if she was out there pretending like, oh yeah, you know, I have no bias in this situation, but she's not. So that's ridiculous. And it's just victim blaming. It's taken out of context. Katy isn't a genuine journalist. She was with Turning Point and Post Millennial, both far-right disinformation provocateurs. That's just ridiculous. The phrase far-right is bizarre. But again, she's not pretending to be a straightforward mainstream journalist. But that doesn't mean that she deserves to be robbed. It doesn't mean that she deserves to be assaulted. It doesn't mean that she deserves to be ignored when she's in a moment of need and needs to contact law enforcement. So, I mean, Jesus, do better. It's absolutely insane. Another commenter tells her, just walk to the nearest business, no problem. It's like, okay, yeah, she can do that, but it's just a little bit of a ridiculous. Journalist, you're not one and she isn't either. I don't claim to be a journalist anymore. I'm a political commentator. I always find it funny when people in my comments are like, you're not a journalist. It's like, yeah, I do political commentary. It says so in my bio. So just really sad to me, the number of people in these comments. When you can be kind of anonymous on Twitter, people just, the worst of humanity comes out. And for them to victim blame and say, oh, well, she's not a journalist, so she deserves what happened to her. Like, that's really freaking gross, people. I mean, it's sad where we've come as a society. So anyway, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on all of this and what happened and, you know, some of the concerns and sentiments I shared about the state of the local media and, you know, them not having a backbone when it comes to left-wing violence, but, you know, jumping all over right-wing violence and really, in a lot of ways, covering for left-wing extremism in a way that should disturb anyone. That's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. I'll be back on Wednesday with a subscriber-only episode. I also want to note that we have made a request to the Renton Police Department in the Katy Davis Court case to, there was a police camera nearby. We're trying to get video of the actual incident that happened to her and then trying to figure out where they're at in their investigation. So hopefully I'll have some answers for you by Wednesday.